This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. North Carolina's General Assembly recently passed the budget for the fiscal year beginning July 1st. Most Democrats, including Governor Bev Perdue, opposed the package, totaling nearly $20 billion. But a handful of Democrats sided with Republicans, and that gave them enough votes to override the governor's veto. Today on the State of Things, we're going to talk about the impact and focus on three areas hardest hit: the environment, education, and women's health care. Up first, the environment. The budget reduces North Carolina's Department of Environment and Natural Resources by 12% overall, and it forbids the state from creating environmental rules that are tougher than federal minimum standards. Dee Freeman is here. He's the Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Tell us about this 12% cut. What's it going to mean? What are you going to have to do?
Well, let's back up a little bit. The 12% cut is as included in the budget for the upcoming year. Let's go back to the end of 2008 and the beginning of 2009 when I started to work at Diener as its secretary. Since that time, our budget, our appropriated budget, has been cut 24%. You add to that the cuts that are in store for next year, you add another 12+%. And if you look at the budget a little more closely, in the second year of the biennium, we're proposed to be cut 22%. So the aggregate total of the cuts to the Department of Environment and Natural Resources are over 40%.
What's that going to mean? What are you going to have to do?
Well, I think it's self-evident on its face what happens when you cut any budget by 40%. It affects your programs. It affects your ability to produce. It affects the policy issues that face the state of North Carolina. And I think the governor put it best. This budget as a whole takes North Carolina backwards. And more poignantly, it takes us backward probably on a generational basis. North Carolina for the last three, four decades has been a leader in environmental programs, natural resource activities, and that is coming to a screeching halt.
But what gets lost? Who's going to lose their jobs, and what's that going to mean for environmental safety in North Carolina?
Who will lose their jobs? We will find that with this budget, we will transfer out of our agency two major divisions, the Division of Forestry and the Division of Soil and Water. When you add the cuts to the budget, you add the transfers, you add other budget actions that are taken, our department will lose almost 1,050 jobs. Mm-hmm. Some of those won't be lost because they'll go over to other areas. But the impact on our budget, we will go from a budget this year of almost $189 million down to $114 million.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, too, because the budget, we talked about the cuts, but also the budget transfers several of your divisions to other state agencies. Can you tell us about that?
Correct. Well, the notion is let's reorganize, let's become more effective, more efficient. The actions taken do none of that. There are no efficiencies. It actually will cost more money by the time we make the changes, both administratively and support-wise. But in effect, I was told early in the session that we don't like your department. We're going to change it. Nothing personal, but we're going to reorganize it. And the reorganization part is not only moving those divisions that I just mentioned, there's provision in the budget to study the remaining natural resource assets of the department. My expectation is that the legislature is headed toward a direction of stripping all the natural resource assets of the department, move them to various places throughout state government, and leave basically an environmental protection agency, a state environmental protection agency, that then can be targeted and can be handcuffed, quite frankly, from doing its job.
Well, what's wrong with moving some of those functions out of your agency and putting it somewhere else? Those functions are still performed. Mm-hmm. Our environment and natural resources mm-hmm. will still be protected?
Maybe. In some cases, it might be the right thing. What I advocated was, okay, there are different models across the country. Some states do have a Department of Natural Resources, and a separate Department of Environmental Protection. Let's look at those models. Let's assess the facts. Let's determine in a sober, measured way what is the best way to do this. In other words, let's study it. Let's determine what the facts are, and then based on those facts, make informed decisions as to what would be the best policy for the state of North Carolina. In the 1970s, when the current structure was put in place, it was intentionally put in place to marry natural resources and environment, because the natural resources aspects of our department help buffer the harshness sometimes that can come with regulatory control.
There are some other cuts. Let's look at some in particular. Clean Water Management Trust Fund cut by 88.5%. Wildlife Resources Commission cut 25%. Conservation funding cut 85%. Now, what does that really mean in terms of what will be lost to the state of North Carolina?
Well, this is what it means. One of the success stories for the state of North Carolina is its conservation program. It has given us such things as Grandfather Mountain State Park, Carver's Creek State Park, Chimney Rock, et cetera, et cetera. We have a goal of protecting 1 million acres. That was a goal originally put in place by Governor Hunt. We have to date protected and conserved almost 680,000 acres. The loss of the Clean Water Management Trust Fund, a cut by almost 90%, that's where the money comes from to do a lot of that. Obviously, with that little money left, and the money that is left is earmarked. The legislature didn't leave it just to be spent by the Clean Water Management Trust Fund Board. They've earmarked exactly how it must be spent. So that is problematic, both for conservation, and that fund is used by local government to put water and sewer infrastructure in place. So all the things that go to make for a better economic climate, if you will, from the standpoint of water and sewer infrastructure, will be greatly at risk because there's no money. And the law required, as put in place many years ago, that the legislature try to set aside $100 million a year for the Clean Water Management Trust Fund. This particular budget repeals that provision.
So the overall, the thrust of the debate on what to do with Diener was that this regulation was burdensome. It was getting to be too much. In fact, there's a provision that says the state may no longer pass regulations tougher than minimum standards by the federal government. And the argument is, look, this is bad for business. You're just driving businesses out with all your environmental regulations and making it costly for them.
We have heard that argument. We have no difficulties with respect to regulatory reform if it is done in a measured and sensible way. But consider this. Before we started down this road, not only that kind of rhetoric in Raleigh, but the same rhetoric you will hear in Washington and in other state capitals, there's a national effort here to go down that path. But consider this for the state of North Carolina. Last fall, Forbes magazine, who rates business friendliness, rated the regulatory environment for the state of North Carolina as the third best in the nation, the third. Yet the rancor that we hear in Raleigh is that you're bad for business, you're in the way, you can't get things out of the way fast enough for us to do our business. We're ranked third in the nation as the best for our regulatory programs. And that spans not only my department, but other departments. But I think that is very telling. We also, since I have been in office, began back in January of 2009, of setting out strategies of how we can improve our environmental permitting. We've put in place programs to enhance our permitting and compliance provisions to specifically help business and particularly individuals who, one, don't necessarily understand rules and regulations, or two, don't have the money to do it. That, I think, in terms of customer services, is much better than just a wholesale cutting of programs and a retreat from the environment.
And environmental regulation protects public health, doesn't
it? Correct.
What impact does that have on the economy and the business environment?
Well, I'll give you an example. One action that still is pending, it's passed one chamber of the legislature, but is still pending, is the notion that the state's air toxics rules be repealed. You mentioned earlier, no standards greater than federal standards. This is all rolled together. And I would say to you that the air toxics laws were put in place when Governor Martin was in office.
When was that?
The early 1990s.
Okay.
And it protects us from emissions to the air of very nasty types of emissions. Let's talk mercury and arsenic and formaldehyde, the types of things that not only will make you sick, it will kill you. And we're not intending in any way to stand in business's way. We want to work with them, help them. But no one has the right to emit these kinds of substances into the air that you and I breathe. The environment is very much, very much a part of the economy. And if the environment is bad, that is certainly bad for business.
Dee, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Dee Freeman, Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources. Just ahead, we're going to take a look at the budget's effect on education. It's going to happen on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about next year's nearly $20 billion budget and its impact on those of us who live in the state of North Carolina. We've talked about environmental safety. Later on, we're going to look at cuts to Planned Parenthood. Right now, let's focus on education. Governor Perdue vetoed the budget. She said she did that in part because the package chopped more than $500 million from her recommended spending on education. Republican lawmakers argue they didn't cut that much and that those reductions won't hurt public instruction. Here's Republican State Representative Nelson Dollar earlier this month on WRAL-TV.
It does spend almost the same amount of money that the governor has recommended in the education field. It has tremendous flexibility for the local school districts, but we have protected the classroom. We've said you've got to spend money on the teachers, you've got to spend money on the teaching assistants, protect the classroom, and take the savings out of those areas that are not core to the classrooms of North Carolina.
That's Wake County Republican State Representative Nelson Dollar. Joining me on the show now is Rukia Dillahunt. She is a community activist who spent more than 33 years teaching in Wake County Public Schools. She is also the treasurer of the retired division of the North Carolina Association of Educators in Wake County. Rukia, welcome to the program. Good to have
you here. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Also on the program with us, Janet Howard, volunteer executive director for the Harriet B. Webster Task Force for Student Success. She's also worked at NC State University for nearly 30 years. Janet, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Rukia, when you listen to Nelson Dollar say they're not going to cut core classroom activities in North Carolina, what does that mean?
Well, to me and what I'm hearing from, you know, school employees is that it's going to be devastating. And I think that I always say that everybody can tell teachers how to teach and people how to run public schools until they go in there themselves. I think we're going to see lots of cuts and the rippling effect on how it affects our students, from school supplies to professional development. That, from my understanding, that is not in the state budget for staff development for teachers. And I think we need to look at, you know, you could talk about Wake County, and maybe the local might be able to provide some staff development, but we have seen staff development funds diminish over the years. The state budget does not allow for the Teacher Academy. The Teacher Academy was an institution that was provided by the state government to allow local districts to have teachers come in and do staff development, professional development, free over the summer and during the school year. This really will affect, Frank, the low-wealth communities and counties in North Carolina. If we look at, you know, Halifax and, you know, a lot of the other counties down east.
Can the schools make these kind of cuts? We're talking about $500 million over the governor's recommendation for school spending. Can they make those kind of cuts and not affect instruction, classroom teachers, or assistants? Where else do schools spend? Where would that money come from if not teaching instructors, teaching assistants, and teachers?
It would have to come from there. I can't figure out how. There is some, I think overhead that perhaps superintendents will look at, but eventually the bulk of the money goes for salary and benefits. And so you can't nickel and dime when you need a lot of money. So you have to go with salaries and benefits. And so that's why they looked at assistant principals. They looked at cutting them to like 10 months rather than 12 months. And then they also said, let's do away with some of the assistant principals. Principals don't need any help. They can run a school, 2,700 students by themselves. And that sounds like extreme, but I think the effects of it. I really want to talk about custodial and clerical services that people provide as school employees. When you're in the little brick schoolhouse, you don't understand, if you're a receptionist, how many hats you wear. From welcoming parents to calling a parent to say your child is sick. We don't have nurses in our schools on a daily basis. So receptionists they play a vital role in the school system and holding the school together, as well as the custodian. And years ago, I can only speak of Wake County, but I think it was a trend around the country to look at contracting custodial and cafeteria workers out. And what research shows is that if someone is not invested in a job, then they can care less. If you contract out, my understanding was that they have to bring their own supplies. Now, we're looking at how many schools that, you're talking about whether someone is a, good custodian coming in to contract, but you have to have all the supplies to clean that school. And so it doesn't work. The custodian, secretary, though, people will tell you once you start working in school, those should be your best friends.
Janet, counselors, I know, and support groups are expected to be hit hard in this budget as well. The nonprofit you work for tries to get kids that have been long-term suspended back on track. So give us a sense of how this is going to affect the counseling, these kids who need a little more time and attention.
We are very concerned for two reasons. One, if counselors are on the list as expendable because it's a support service, then we may have even more long-term suspended students because they don't have a connect to work on the behavior, the expectation. Then to compound that, if we're looking at cutting, or the state has said no more dropout prevention programming, we're thinking that Wake County may not have the resources to support what we've been doing with our long-term suspended students since 2003. Even though we were serving a very small group of students countywide, when you consider the total number of students who have been long-term suspended, we were at least making some impact. So these cuts could essentially provide no funding for the long-term suspended program. Then if there are fewer counselors in the school, I'm thinking we're going to see more students suspended.
Well, and there's a correlation. I'd like to stop you there just to get a sense of what that might mean for the long term, because there is a correlation, isn't there, between those students who have had long-term suspensions and their futures in terms of whether they get a job and whether they come in contact with the criminal justice system.
You are exactly right. We're looking at data that supports strongly when students are long-term suspended, especially repeatedly, they do not complete high school. So we know what that means in relationship to the criminal justice system and just the learning of the student. We also know that when students have these repeated suspensions, even those that aren't long-term, say 3 days, 6 days, 10 days, that also negatively impacts their learning, their achievement, then what do we have? Lots of dropouts. The ninth grade year is still the critical year for dropouts in Wake County and nationwide. So we really have to think about these cuts. Preserving the classroom teachers, yes, we're very serious about that. We want to see that happen. Reducing the numbers in the earlier grades, we want to see that happen. However, as Rakia just said, we have to think about those support services, everyone from the custodial staff through the counselors.
Well, Rakia, and it raises the question, too, even on these short-term suspensions, if there aren't counselors there in the schools when these kids come back after suspension, it really raises the question of what happens next. And you might guess that without counselors and support services, more kids are going to be suspended. I mean, that's the easy way to fix the problem until they come back and there's no one to counsel them.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, Janet is right. And I think that, you know, for people in the community, I want them to understand that the programs that Janet is talking about are vital because, you know, when you don't have a place and you're long-term suspended, you stay home. If you stay home, then you have so much time to get into, what, trouble in our communities. And so these are students who make maybe one mistake. And they're lost for a long period of time. And so that money is so key to make sure that we keep students in school, right, and provide for them the quality education, you know, that they rightly deserve.
We're talking about eliminating positions here, but I know that the Republicans in the General Assembly have said that this really doesn't have to happen. It just takes requires a more creative look at how the spending has gone. Now, this is Republican House Speaker Tom Tillis. You're talking about how the budget allows for flexibility and also creativity, and talking about a possible solution in Wake County.
They've said that what they're going to do so that they can keep some teacher assistants versus all the rhetoric about thousands having to be laid off is to maybe shorten the length of time, maybe not have them there on non-teaching days, and shorten the calendar, deal with the calendar. So there are other ways that they could actually work it with the flexibility we have in this budget to preserve a lot of those positions if they go to work at it.
As Republican Speaker Tom Tillis speaking on UNC TV, so Rukia, there's just a little bit of this is an opportunity to become more efficient as a school system.
Efficient and flexible, but you know, the calendar is devised by the state school board. So schools don't have that flexibility to say, okay, we're going to extend the time. My understanding with the 5 days that they're talking about either doing away with teacher work days and perhaps allowing students to be in time, I think research has shown that 5 days really won't make a difference, that if we want to talk about education and really growing and looking at international and how people do things, we need more days, 20 to 30 days, but you have to pay people to work. And that's something that, you know, the last 4 years, do you realize that teachers have not gotten a raise? 4 years straight. And with the cost of living, unemployment, and I think that we need to look at, you know, young people going into the teaching field. Many years ago, I used to tell everybody that are looking for a job, go into teaching. Mm-hmm. You will always have a job, not knowing that in 2011,
yes,
that we will be devastated by, you know, dismantling. What I feel that they're doing is dismantling public education piece by piece.
And do you think, Janet, I'll ask both of you, but I'll start with you, Janet, that these cuts will be felt differently depending on which school district you're from, and rural and urban schools feel things differently?
Of course. You are exactly right. Rakia referred earlier to Halifax and some of those counties down east that don't have as much local supplement. They may not have as much federal funding. And when you're talking about 60% or more of your budget coming directly from the state, and that's about the average for the state according to public instruction, then those counties will be harder hit than higher wealth counties like Wake and others.
Some of those counties have already been feeling that, and the disparity, I guess, is already present in those schools. So we'd see some of that. But here's the other thing. Now, there were two ways to go. One way would be to cut, of course. Another possibility that wasn't really considered seriously in this this particular session was to raise revenue. That's another way you kind of reach it. Now, Representative Nelson Dollar, again, Wake County, speaking on WRAL-TV, said that's just not something they wanted to consider.
The best thing we can do for our economy is cut the sales tax rate, put $1.3 billion back into the economy over the course of the next year to help create private sector jobs. We need private sector job growth.
Now, he's referring to the fact that there was a 1 cent sales tax, an increase in the sales tax. It was due to expire. They let that expire. So sales tax was one. Of course, you could have raised income tax. You could have raised corporate. I mean, there were other possibilities as well. But his point, you know, that these taxes are a problem when you try to create private sector jobs, which get the economy going. What about that?
Well, you know, I think we shouldn't pit one against the other, but I think we do need to look at our future. And if our future lies in young people, then they have to be educated, because you can have these corporations, and corporations come into North Carolina cheap. And they don't have to pay any taxes. And I think that that's wrong. And you have a lot of people in our community.
Well, corporations pay taxes in North Carolina.
Very little.
Right, but they do pay some
taxes.
A
little bit.
Because okay.
Most of them, I know one in particular, may have their headquarters in Delaware, and there's no taxes in Delaware, and they have their, you know, corporation's base is in North Carolina. So I hear you. I think NCAE had the idea about the penny tax and collecting pennies, you know, to show like one penny. I think if you surveyed and people did, the public, 1 cent will not make or break you. And that would mean a lot to particularly the school budget. So I think that that's real important for us to look at that. In essence, that paying taxes, public schools are for every citizen. People will pay taxes if they have the quality education for their children.
Also, go ahead, Janet.
I'm thinking, too, corporations want to come where you have a well-trained, well-educated workforce. So even though he's saying we need to open this up and make it a friendly place for corporations, if we have a poor educational system, we have ill-prepared students, ill-prepared adults to work, we will lose our attraction.
Of course, North Carolina now falls to number 49 in the nation for per capita spending on education.
Education. Right.
And that shows up in all of the reports. So
yes,
when you're a corporate and you're putting this out to the board, that's the first thing that shows up. And what about this business of a private – we have to build private sector jobs. There are a lot of public sector jobs that will be lost. Is one job better than the other in terms of its impact on the economy? Is $40,000 earned by a teacher less important to an economy than $40,000 earned by somebody in the pharmaceutical industry?
That's a good question. I don't know how that can be. I'm thinking that he's only thinking of tax dollars supporting public jobs, and that public-private money, of course, is less related. But each tax public employer spends money with the private businesses. So really, as Rekia said, one is not better than the other, and we really need to work together. You're right. One is not better than the other.
How have things changed, Rekia? You talked about the fact that you always recommended people go into this business. It was good. It was good. The state has always understood this. North Carolina has been a leader, particularly in the South, progressive ideas about education. What has changed?
Well, I think working conditions have changed and will constantly change now with these budget cuts. I mean, from teachers being revitalized by going to professional development, staff development, we call it, everybody needs a little, you know, to get back from whether it's the summer or whether it's in mid-year to bring knowledge to their students. And, you know, if you talk to teachers and school employees, they tell you they are constant learners, lifelong learners. And in order to do that, you have to have some knowledge coming in that's different, you know, in the education reform. So I think that, you know, working conditions, students are not allowed to go on that many field trips, if any. That's gone.
Is it true that some students are now having to bring in supplies to get?
Oh, yes.
their own, I mean, not just their own pencils and paper,
no.
but to supply the school, to do photocopying, all that.
Teachers send home
stamps,
a wish,
right?
yes,
yeah.
a wish list. They call it a wish list. Mm-hmm. And they send it home to parents, and parents are donating paper, pencils, eraser for eraser board markers, tissue for colds when students have colds. It's amazing.
I think what's interesting, too, is that North Carolina sits specially in the nation, I think, because we have so many excellent colleges and universities in the state. We get to keep a lot of people who come here and train. And even though I think we moved from 44th to maybe 49th, our students are performing near the average and in some cases above the average when we look at national standards like SAT, ACT, and even end of grade or achievement in reading, writing, and math. I'm thinking a lot of that attraction for better teachers has been the support we have given education over the years. So if we're talking about cutting back now, I think we'll get fewer teachers, fewer of them will stay in North Carolina, and this location we've had in relationship to some of our students doing very well, when we look at the average, we're looking at the average now, I'm thinking that's going to decrease.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank both of you for being on the show today. Janet Howard, a volunteer executive director for the Harriet B. Webster Task Force for Student Success, also taught and worked for more than 30 years at NC State. Rukia Dillahunt is a community activist who spent more than 33 years teaching in Wake County Public Schools. Thank both of you for being on the program. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up on The State of Things, we're going to take a look at the effect on women's health of the new state budget. Take a look at funding for Planned Parenthood. When our program continues, please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour about the new state budget. It includes big cuts to public education, environmental protection, and women's health. Conservatives around the country have made defunding Planned Parenthood a priority because the group provides abortion services. Planned Parenthood also provides a range of health education as well as cancer screenings, STD testing, and birth control. Much of that service is provided to low-income men and women. The new budget eliminates all public funding to that organization. Joining me to talk about it is Allison Kaiser. She's field manager at Planned Parenthood of Central North Carolina. Allison, welcome to the program. Good to
have you. Thanks so much for having me.
Before we talk about the budget, we should also mention that yesterday Governor Bev Perdue vetoed a bill that would have required counseling and 24-hour waiting period before women could get an abortion. She called it a dangerous intrusion to the confidential relationship that exists between women and their doctors. What's your reaction to that?
Well, Planned Parenthood applauds Governor Perdue's veto of House Bill 854, and we think she got it exactly right. It would impose medically unnecessary delays and biased counseling that's written by politicians, not by doctors, for women seeking abortion care in North Carolina. So we think that she said it exactly right when she said that women deserve care that's provided to the best of the doctor's medical knowledge and ability, and that the government has no business entering into the exam room.
We said Planned Parenthood provides services other than abortions. It does provide abortions as well. Tell us about some of the other services.
Well, Planned Parenthood, the vast majority of our services are preventative or primary in nature. What I mean by primary is basic reproductive health care services that people seek in order to keep themselves healthy, such as annual exams, pap tests, cervical cancer screenings, breast exams, STI testing and treatment. We provide all of those services at our health centers, and the vast majority of our services are, as I said, preventative and primary.
And not all Planned Parenthood clinics offer abortions, isn't that right?
That's correct. We are proud of the fact that people can come to us for compassionate abortion care, but not all of our health centers do provide those services. Some of them are just these primary preventative services like the cancer screenings and birth control, I was talking about.
Now, even though no federal or state money goes to providing abortions, it's conceivable that the funding, it does free that money up for, I mean, if you just move the money around, so it's...
Well, that's the claim by people who were proponents of this defunding measure. But in actual fact, that is not the case. First of all, the Hyde Amendment has prohibited funding for abortion, federal funding to go to abortion, for 35 years now. So that's not really the issue. And Planned Parenthood operates just like every hospital that provides abortion care. We are reimbursed by the state for exactly the services that we provide. So those services being like the preventative services, birth control under Title 10, for example, or cervical cancer screenings for low-income women.
So you have to apply for reimbursement for a particular procedure from a particular patient, and if it's not like money goes from one pot into another and just...
That's correct. There are very strict reporting standards, and we always follow the letter of the law.
What's the impact of this defunding now?
Well, the impact is really unfortunate because it's going to impact our patients most of all. The funding streams that are being cut are... Title 10, which is actually a federal funding stream. And unfortunately, even though it's federal money, it does pass through the state first. So because of that, we actually will not be able to access this Title 10 funding.
And what does that do?
Title 10 is best known as birth control for low-income women, but in fact, it's much broader than that. It's not only family planning services. It also includes these cervical cancer screenings, breast exams, STI testing, and that sort of thing for low-income women. And again, this is federal money that passes through the state, but that we will no longer be able to access to give low-income women who come to us as a trusted community provider to give them those services that they depend on. Two other funding streams provide teen pregnancy prevention programs and also long-acting contraceptives for low-income women.
Now, the one argument against funding Planned Parenthood is that women can get these services elsewhere. I'm going to play a clip here. This is Republican Senator Tom Apodaca. Let's listen.
I don't think I have a Planned Parenthood in Hendersonville. But what we do have in Hendersonville is one of the finest free clinics in North Carolina. So I think a community will look after the folks in that community. And I don't necessarily think Planned Parenthood's the organization that would do all these great things for a community.
It's Tom Apodaca. He's a Republican senator. What about that? We're not defunding women's health care or reproductive health care. It's just Planned Parenthood.
Well, the first thing I want to point out is that this defunding measure does not save the state a dime, not a single penny. It simply says Planned Parenthood, you as an organization cannot contract with the state in any way. We are not going to fund you a single penny, but that money is still out there. And now in a perfect world, women and men who depend on organizations like Planned Parenthood to provide them with affordable health care would always have someplace else to turn. But unfortunately, in reality, that's simply not the case. Those who would state that women can just go someplace else to seek these vital health care services, our public health departments are right now at capacity. A typical wait time for a family planning visit at a public health department in North Carolina in an urban area is 3 months. So that's just not something that's feasible for someone who needs those services immediately. And Planned Parenthood could see that same woman seeking family planning services that very week, if not that very day.
What about just moving the money from Planned Parenthood to those other either state agencies or those free clinics?
Well, I think that's what they're kind of claiming they're going to do. In the first place, the big picture is that these women and to some degree men have relied on Planned Parenthood as their trusted community health care provider, in some cases for many years. And that's just simply not fair to those patients to say, well, we as a state government decided that we don't like that organization anymore for whatever reason, and you're just going to have to figure something else out. Furthermore, we're not talking about a huge pool of money. We're talking about for the thousands of women and men that Planned Parenthood serves every year, I can't say for certain, but I would not think that that pool of money would make the necessary services available to them just simply by directing it to other organizations.
And so tell us who's going to be most directly affected by these particular cuts to Planned Parenthood.
The real losers in the situation are the patients, which is very unfortunate. And it's the patients who will lose access to the affordable care that they've depended on. And it's really going to disproportionately impact low-income women in particular. And so the legislators who have pushed this measure are people who in 2009 were in opposition to Planned Parenthood's efforts to reintroduce comprehensive sex education to North Carolina. So this to us is simply an attack on women's health, an attack on family planning, attack on pro-prevention measures.
How many men and women does Planned Parenthood serve in North Carolina?
Well, I can tell you the numbers I have in front of me in terms of services that we provided just in the last year alone. We provided more than 18,000 tests for sexually transmitted infections in North Carolina, more than 11,000 breast and cervical cancer screenings, and more than 61,000 contraceptives in North Carolina alone.
So what do these cuts mean to Planned Parenthood? Will it survive?
Yes, Planned Parenthood will survive. As an organization, we've been around for almost 100 years, and we're not going anywhere. There are too many people that depend on us. This is not really about the future of Planned Parenthood. It's about the future of these men and women who depend on our services and where they're going to go to find these services if, in fact, they can't get them at the affordable rate that they depend on at Planned Parenthood. So, yes, Planned Parenthood is exploring all options to make sure that we do not have to turn any patient away who needs our services.
What are some of those options?
Well, I think that we saw in Indiana. Indiana was one of the first states that had a similar defunding measure introduced. They were able to do quite a bit of additional fundraising. And immediately, as soon as these attacks on Planned Parenthood and reproductive health care started, we saw lots of donations coming in, our current donors really stepping up to contribute, new donors who were outraged by the attacks. And so soliciting new and current donors is for their support is certainly something that many Planned Parenthoods are doing. But that in terms of a long-term strategy, we're also considering litigation. Really nothing is off the table right now.
What do you think is the long-term and the near-term impact for the state itself? These people who have used Planned Parenthood services are going to go somewhere, we assume. State health agencies, public health agencies would be a good bet. What's going to be the impact on those agencies? You talked about and free clinics and the response. In other words, what's the total cost of this to having people move and try to find these resources elsewhere? As you shift the burden from one agency to another,
right? Well, I think that I think in the first place, it's important to say that we do not plan to turn any patients away, and as I said, we're pursuing all options to make sure that doesn't happen. But really, this was a very short-sighted move. For every $1 the state spends in preventing unintended pregnancy, the state actually saves almost $4. So this was a very short-sighted move on the behalf of the General Assembly. And I'm afraid to say that if it turned out that Planned Parenthood was not available as an option for these low-income women and men to seek services, I'm afraid that there's just not the capacity there for them to all be served, unfortunately.
Does the impact vary from region to region in the state of North Carolina in terms of Planned Parenthood services? Give us a sense of how things are different from one place to another in North Carolina.
Right. I think that it would certainly disproportionately impact low-income women and men, as I said, as opposed to your more middle-class, middle-income people. And people in rural areas are certainly disproportionately affected as well, simply because there tend to be fewer options that exist in those areas. But at the same time, this will really negatively impact people across the state because, as I said earlier, it's still in these urban areas, which have presumably the largest public health departments and the most resources of all the counties in North Carolina. Wait for a family planning visit, there is still 3 months. So it would very negatively impact people across the state, regardless of what areas they live in.
You talked about some examples. I think Indiana you mentioned, and Wisconsin was another state. Am I right about that?
Indiana was first, and we saw over the weekend that a judge granted them an injunction for the defunding measure that passed as part of their budget. I believe Wisconsin is one, Kansas is another. We are seeing sort of a trend of these attacks cropping up in the states across the nation. You'll recall that earlier this year, we saw attacks like this at the federal level, which were defeated by Congress. And so states have really been, with these conservative legislatures, just attacks on women's health care across the board.
What's the basis of the legal strategy, and if an injunction was granted, on what grounds?
Well, I can't. I'm not a great legal mind or anything. So I will say that the injunction in Indiana was granted on the grounds that the defunding measure in Indiana actually also applied to Medicaid reimbursement, which the defunding measure for Planned Parenthood in North Carolina does not apply to Medicaid, because that is, in fact, and this was the grounds for the injunction, that is, in fact, illegal to tell people with a certain kind of insurance like Medicaid, well, you can't go to that provider. Why? Because we don't like them. That's illegal.
What about the federal funding? The fact that it is caught up in this is because the state of North, it passes through state hands, but it is a federal decision. Is there any sort of legal grounds there to say, well, the money was intended there, you're the fiduciary, but does the state of North Carolina have the right to not pass through money?
And I guess, should we choose to litigate, as I said, all options are on the table. Should we file a lawsuit? That's something that our attorneys would certainly consider.
And in the meantime, you're talking about not turning anybody away, possibly looking at legal action. Do you think donors will step up? Does this improve your status and your ability to raise funds elsewhere?
I think we saw at the national level that was certainly the case, that we saw an influx of especially small donations, people who maybe don't have a whole lot of money but were so outraged by these attacks on basic primary preventative health care for women, they felt they just had to give something. And I think that the more the word gets out about this in North Carolina and in states across the country, we are seeing people who recognize that, you know, it's now is the time to make sure that these attacks are defeated in any way they can help, they want to.
Allison, thank you so very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I've been talking with Allison Kaiser. She is field manager at Planned Parenthood of Central North Carolina. And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. As always, if you have a comment about the show or you want to hear an archived edition of a past program, go to our website, stateofthings.org. We're also on Facebook. You can follow us there. We've got a calendar of events. Anything that we talk about on the show shows up on Facebook, and you can follow us there as well. The State of Things is produced by Alex Granados and Jeremy Loeb. Our intern is Anna Cassell. Robin Copley is the technical director. Our managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. And Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.